for Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
What I'm saying is everything indicates that this capture of a city of more than 1 million people was staged, because it's impossible for a force of 1,000 rebels to come in and take over a city of 1 million when it has a standing army of 30,000. The command structure was under Shiite control. It was not under Sunni control. You know, the commander general of those forces was a very close associate of al-Maliki, and he left the city. So presumably he left the city because somebody told him to leave the city, or he was co-opted to doing that. It's a very well-equipped army. It would have decimated those 1,000 rebels in no time with U.S. advanced technologies, helicopters, and so on.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Michelle Chosadovsky. Today's show, ISIS, an instrument of the Western Military Alliance. Michelle Chosadovsky is an economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. He is the author of The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, and America's War on Terrorism. His most recent article is The Engineered Destruction and Political Fragmentation of Iraq, Towards the Creation of a U.S.-Sponsored Islamist Caliphate. Today we discuss ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, and its recent rampage through northern Iraq. Who comprises this rebel militia? Who is supporting it? The origins of the Sunni Caliphate? Long-standing U.S. agenda for the Middle East? The effect of Iraqi political fragmentation on Syria and Iran, and the breakup of nation-states within the larger global geopolitical framework. Michelle Chosadovsky, welcome.
Delighted to be on Guns and Butter.
All of a sudden, seemingly out of the blue, the media was filled with pictures and stories of a horde called ISIS, which came barreling across northern Iraq, seemingly unopposed, with cities falling like dominoes. The Iraqi army, it was reported, dropped their weapons and fled, some even removing their uniforms. I saw pictures on the internet of guys riding on cream-colored trucks, the men all sporting matching black outfits and carrying black flags with white Arabic inscriptions on them. Iraq's second largest city, Mosul, is now in their hands. What is ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria? And did it spring from nowhere?
Well, the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, sometimes called also the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, is really an offshoot of an al-Qaeda-based organization, which emerged pretty much even before the U.S. invasion. It was associated with Zarqawi, the mysterious al-Qaeda leader. It was initially identified as the Islamic State of Iraq until about a year ago, and then it became the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. And it was then integrated into the rebel forces which were fighting the government of Bashar al-Assad. Now, I should mention that ISIS is a U.S. Intelligence asset. It is a creation of U.S. intelligence. It's funded by Qatar and Saudi Arabia on behalf of Washington. It is recruited, as far as the Syrian insurgency is concerned, in the Gulf states. It's composed of mercenaries. It is a U.S. instrument. And what we witnessed in the last week or so is the movement of rebel forces of ISIS from Syria into Iraq, and the so-called takeover and occupation of the second largest city, which is Mosul. Now, if we start to analyze this terrorist entity, we first must address the fact that there were approximately 1,000 rebels involved, as opposed to 30,000 regular forces of the Iraqi military, which were based in Mosul. And something occurred within the military command structures which enabled the rebels to take control of the city. But before I get into that, I'd like to explain that within these rebel formations, and we know that from the war in Syria, you have Western military advisors. Many of those, actually, of those Western military advisors and mercenaries were arrested by the Syrian government forces. So we know that they have special forces within these brigades. Now, these special forces within these brigades are also in liaison with command structures of the Western Military Alliance, NATO and the U.S. And they also may be in liaison with their counterparts, special forces, which are advising the Iraqi armed forces. Those Iraqi armed forces, although they're not under structure of joint command like in some other countries, like Korea, South Korea, nonetheless, the United States equips, oversees those Iraqi forces, and ultimately calls the shots. So what I'm saying is, first of all, you had communication between special forces within ISIS, which were accompanying the terrorist brigades, and their counterparts in the Iraqi forces. I'm talking about Western military advisors, mercenaries, and we know that Iraq is swarming with mercenaries, very large numbers, particularly since the withdrawal of U.S. forces. And what I'm saying is everything indicates that this capture of a city of more than 1 million people was staged, because it's impossible for a force of 1,000 rebels to come in and take over a city of 1 million when it has a standing army of 30,000. And the Western media has pointed to defections within those armed forces as the main cause, but defections do not explain. Because when there are defections, the question is, what happens to the command structure? The command structure was under Shiite control. It was not under Sunni control. The main, you know, the commander general of those forces was a very close associate of al-Maliki, and he left the city. So presumably he left the city because somebody told him to leave the city, or he was co-opted to doing that. And so that there was a collapse in the command structures of that formidable force of 30,000 men, which can only be explained when we look at the, you know, at the structure of those armed forces, the links to the U.S. military, and so on and so forth. It's a very well-equipped army. It would have decimated those 1,000 rebels in no time, with U.S. advanced technologies, helicopters, and so on. And it's not defections which would have prevented this military from operating. So what I'm suggesting is, A, there was communication between the rebels, which are essentially an intelligence asset of the Western Military Alliance, the foot soldiers of the Western Military Alliance in Syria, well documented, and they are performing a specific role within within Iraq, which is essentially to create divisions and eventually to trigger the destruction of Iraq as a nation state and as a unified country. And the tendency now is towards the breakup of Iraq into three separate entities, one being the so-called caliphate, the Sunni caliphate, which has been a long-standing objective of U.S. foreign policy. It's not an objective of the Iraqi people. The second is independent Kurdistan, which is almost de facto in northern Iraq. And I should mention that Kurdistan is also supported by Israel. And then you would have some kind of Shia Arab Republic. That is the objective for both Iraq and Syria. And it is something which has been very carefully engineered to the extent that not only is the United States supporting ISIS, but it is also it has also been able to, in a sense, dismantle the resistance movement against aggression and occupation. The tribal organizations, as well as the former Baathists, which we might say constitute the secular resistance. They're not associated with an extremist, fundamentalist, jihadist movement. But these groups have now stated, first of all, they've acknowledged and said, no, ISIS did not liberate Mosul. They said, we liberated Mosul. Now, I think the first part of the statement is correct. ISIS didn't liberate. The insurgent forces came in, and in all likelihood, this was carefully planned, and it was carefully planned by the United States and its allies. If this is not the case, then the United States would have made sure that Iraqi military forces would have acted on their behalf. But bear in mind, inasmuch as ISIS is not an independent entity in its own right, it's an instrument of the United States and its allies, this rebel force was sent in with its Western military advisors. And the objective was essentially to destabilize the government in Baghdad and to create divisions within Iraqi society, which will lead towards a scenario of civil war.
Well, now, you have said that mercenaries, that is paid soldiers, are all over the nation of Iraq. Are the members of ISIS itself, are these mercenaries?
Well, I would suspect that as far as ISIS is concerned, you have Iraqis which are part of this organization. Historically, it was an Iraqi organization going back to 2003, but it was supported covertly by the United States. And I should mention that when John Negroponte was ambassador and Robert Stephen Ford was number two at the U.S. Embassy, they not only set up the Shia death squads, but they also ensured the formation of the so-called Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was under the auspices of this mysterious character, Musab al-Zarqawi. But in essence, we can say that a large number of the recruits are Iraqi. But then when it started up in Syria, and that was in April 2013, and it changed its name to ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, then what we got is a process more also of recruitment through Qatar, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states. And there I would suspect that they're foreign fighters, a large number of foreign fighters, Iraqis, and a scatter of special forces which are there. Some of them may be covert, some of them may be actually accompanying the groups. They will not know necessarily that these are representatives of the Western Military Alliance, although the leaders might. And that is the basis of the liaison with their counterparts. So this is an intelligence op. It's a scenario which is now occurring in the wake of the official withdrawal of U.S. troops, but it is also there to ensure, well, it's there essentially to break Iraq as a nation state and to trigger fighting between the various factions.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosudovsky. Today's show, ISIS, an instrument of the Western Military Alliance. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, now, what role would you say that the Maliki government in Baghdad is playing? If this so-called invasion by ISIS was staged, do you think the Maliki government is cooperating, or do you think, in a bizarre twist, the United States is portrayed in the media as coming to the rescue of the Iraq state? There's a big discussion about this in the media. Is this portrayal accurate? According to the Fiscal Times, quote, "The prospect of Iraq breaking apart would be a body blow to American foreign policy. Cultivated over the last decade and a half, Americans have invested more than $1 trillion and thousands of American lives in a stable Iraq," unquote. Does the U.S. want a stable Iraq?
No, the U.S. doesn't want a stable Iraq. What we have is a situation whereby a so-called civil war has been triggered, and what's happening is that the United States is supporting both sides. It's supporting the Maliki government, which is a U.S. proxy government. We know that. It takes its orders from Washington. It is providing it with a lot of military hardware, including F-16s, and Iraq. Ambassador of the United States just about a week ago was in Texas to take delivery of F-16s. Now, you might ask yourself, what is the use of F-16s when you're fighting a rebel army? Well, the use is that it's a big contract for Lockheed Martin. So there's billions and billions of dollars going to the U.S. defense contractors, so-called defense contractors. And at the same time, this government is firmly supported by the United States. So they're coming to the rescue of the Maliki government, against a terrorist entity which is controlled by Washington. Okay, so it's a very insidious intelligence op. You support both sides. You support the Maliki government with the sophisticated weapons and so on and so forth, military advisors, mercenaries, there are more than 100,000 mercenaries in Iraq, apparently, according to sources. And then on the other hand, you support these terrorists, and we know that ISIS is supported covertly by the United States because it's the pattern which was set in the Soviet-Afghan war and in all subsequent wars whereby terrorist formations were supported covertly by U.S. intelligence. So it's a sinister process of supporting both sides, arming both sides, and eventually creating conditions for the collapse of the institutions of a nation state. Its economy, its education, its health, all that, of course, has already been destroyed. But this notion that the United States wants a stable Iraq is nonsensical. What they want is a territory that is open to Western investors with little in terms of regulation and negotiation with officials. It's a very diabolical process of reconquest, and it is also a process of redrawing the borders of the Middle East in the same way as the Federation of Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia was divided into seven countries. Can you imagine? Seven small countries in the Balkans. Now, what is contemplated with regard to Iraq is the creation of three countries, and they may overlap with Syria as well as with Iran. Now, the other element which is emerging now is that Iran is being sucked into this conflict, and the discussions which took place between the United States and Iran in Vienna just a couple of days back point to the fact that the United States is willing to collaborate with Iran in the campaign against the ISIS terrorists. Now, the irony is that Iran is supporting the Maliki government, and at the same time, Iran also has special forces inside Iraq on behalf of the Maliki government, and at the same time, it is involved in the counter-terrorism operation against ISIS. Everybody knows that this is fake because, and they say, the Western media is saying the U.S. and Iran have a mutual interest in stemming the advance of terrorism, blah, blah, blah. It's an absurd proposition, knowing that ISIS is a creature of U.S. intelligence, financed by the Western military alliance, trained with Western forces in its ranks, and Tehran knows that, okay? They have their own intelligence services, but they're using the ISIS pretext as an opportunity to intervene in Iran, so that this could potentially lead into a regional conflict, particularly if Iran gets overtly involved in Iraq, and it would be some kind of repeat of the Iran-Iraq war. I think it's worth noting that from a military standpoint, the U.S. is not really doing anything. They said they're sending in something like 300 troops essentially to protect their assets, but they're not doing anything, at least for the moment. But we're at a very dangerous crossroads because on the one hand, we have a terrorist organization controlled by the United States, which is entering Iraqi cities, but also we have a resistance movement. Let's say it's a secular resistance movement. It's made up of the tribal organizations, including the Tribal Revolutionary Council, as well as sections of the former Ba'athist movement, including the military. But these forces, although they're dead against the ISIS, they said, no, we can't collaborate with ISIS, the very dangerous terrorist organization, but they are now saying that they may have to collaborate with ISIS because ISIS is involved in a process which serves their interests. In other words, we have a mutual interest in liberating cities, and they are liberating the cities alongside the resistance movement. But the irony is that they don't understand the resistance movement, the broader Iraqi resistance movement, don't understand or don't want to understand that ISIS is an instrument of the United States. And they are also in the process of shifting their emphasis away from the fact that Iraq was invaded and occupied by the United States to the role of Iran, the interference of Iran in affairs of a sovereign country, I think quite rightly so, but at the same time, the role of the aggressor nation, you know, has been removed to the extent that some leaders of the tribal movement are actually saying we need Western help, and if we don't get Western help, and I quote, and this is a statement by a leader of the political wing of the Tribal Revolutionary Council based in Amman, And what he says is the following, that without Western help, the tribes and ISIS may be forced to combine efforts targeting their shared enemy, the Shia-dominated Iraqi government. So that essentially what we are seeing now, first of all, is that the resistance movement is becoming sectarian. It's the Sunni resistance movement. There's no such thing as a national resistance movement which regroups all the different, you know, the Shia and the Sunni and the Christians and so on. That era has gone. And at the same time, it seems like the resistance movement is not the resistance movement against the aggressor nation, which still controls the government of Iraq. It is the resistance movement against the Shia government. So it becomes sectarian, and then the shift of emphasis is Iran instead of the United States, although now they're accusing Iran of collaborating with the United States.
Well, yes, with regard to Iran, I hear talk now in the media about Iran and the United States getting together to fight the Sunni menace. Are the U.S. and Iran really having a possible rapprochement, as the media claims? They say it's the, quote, silver lining of the crisis. Or will we more likely see a reenactment of the Iran-Iraq war?
I think it's an absurd proposition to say that the U.S. and Iran have a mutual interest. And certainly they don't have a mutual interest in stemming the advance of ISIS, which is a U.S. intelligence asset. Okay, the United States has an interest in making sure that ISIS continues to create violence and atrocities, as we have seen in the last few days, the killing of people, the mass killings and beheadings and so on. And those atrocities, incidentally, are very similar to those which occurred in Syria, and they're being implemented under the same, under the same kind of fundamentalist framework, because all these people are very carefully trained. So the United States' interest is to ensure that ISIS continues. It's certainly not going to start bombing ISIS, okay? They need ISIS. And to say that they're going to collaborate with Iran, I think the U.S. policy objective is one of very careful deceit and a staged type of process whereby Iran would be sucked into the Iraqi civil war, which would then lead possibly to a regional conflict. And it could be a regional conflict on sectarian lines. I should mention there's another dimension to that, is of course that Iran also has a significant Kurdish community. And the United States has even been contemplating for years now that the formation of a so-called Free Kurdistan, which would be made up of portions of Syria, Iraq, and Iran, you know, that is the proposal. It's to create a Kurdistan which would ultimately create conditions possibly of civil war within Iran as well, okay? And so that you're in a situation where the borders of that entire region are being redefined, not only in Iraq. I think the ultimate objective of the United States is also to redraw the borders of Syria and Iran. Now, as to whether they'll be able to achieve that, but at the moment, what seems to be the unfolding scenario is a territorial division of Iran, where Sunni caliphate is in the process of formation.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, ISIS, an instrument of the Western Military Alliance. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Now, how are these military developments in Iraq going to affect Syria? Hasn't the Syrian government been prevailing over the rebels or mercenaries? Of course, at great cost, because Syria has been torn apart. So how is this going to affect Syria? And also, what do you think about the timing of this invasion by these ISIS forces? Why now?
First of all, I think that in the wake of the Syrian elections, the possibilities of the insurrection within Syria are limited, because essentially that insurgency has been in large part defeated by Syrian government forces, and a large part of the national territory is under government control. I suspect that what the United States will be contemplating, it will continue with its efforts to destabilize Syria, to create a humanitarian crisis. It will be involved in ad hoc terrorist undertakings. It will also be involved in economic warfare. And all those things are there to destabilize Syria as a nation state. And it will now integrate the process of destabilization between the two countries, because now it has an insurgency in Iraq, which is the same group as in Syria. And that integration of the insurgency corresponds to geopolitical objectives. It was formulated with a view, essentially, to facilitate a transition in Iraq, but also it also has implications for Syria. And I think what they want to do now is to garnish and encourage the broader support of ISIS by the Sunni population in Iraq. That won't happen in Syria, okay? Certainly not now. There's no support among the Sunni community for the terrorist organizations. But in Iraq, ISIS is seen as fighting the Shia government, and it is also entering into some form of de facto alliance with the secular resistance, the Ba'athist movement, as well as the tribal movement. And so it's going to get more support. And once it has more support, it will also be able to perform a broader role at the regional level. And it could, in fact, even go back to Syria with reinforced brigades and so on and so forth. But one element which struck me, and which is very important, a few days before the elections in Syria on June 3rd, Turkey started cutting water supplies down the Euphrates, and there was also a terrorist attack on water facilities, dam facilities. And there was very little reporting on this, but essentially those events are cutting water off to Syria, but cutting water also off to Iraq, because the Euphrates comes from Turkey and goes into Syria and Iraq, and so that control over those waterways is a means. It's environmental warfare. It's there to destroy people's livelihoods, destroy agriculture, their access to drinking water, and so on and so forth. And, I mean, ironically, the reports that came out in the Western media regarding the water wars, which I think is the correct designation, was to say that there was a secondary market, a black market for water in northern Syria. But they didn't say why. They didn't say why. They didn't say that there was a decision by Turkey to cut the water off to Syria, which is it's a criminal undertaking to do that. And so what I'm suggesting is that to destroy a nation state, you destroy its economy, you destroy its environment, its agriculture. And all avenues, as Hillary Clinton will say, all options on the table from that point of view. It's economic sanctions, it's environmental warfare, it's the use of terrorist organizations, it's the triggering of civil wars and so on and so forth. And I think that the avenue which the United States has chosen now with regard to Iran is that it's easier to suck them into a new Iraq-Iran conflict, which inevitably would be of a sectarian nature, with Iran supporting the Maliki government on the one hand against the Sunnis. But that avenue is far more straightforward than envisaging a preemptive nuclear attack against Iran, okay, which has been on the, it's been on the drawing board for the last 10 years. But it just so happens that Iran has a very advanced anti-missile system and so on and so forth. But now what is being contemplated is the extension of this non-conventional warfare, where you implement conflict within a country that you want to ultimately control. And you don't necessarily want this country to remain as a country. That is, I think, the conclusion I'm reaching, is that the U.S. option today, not only in Iraq, but you can look at Nigeria, Mali, Central African Republic, it's not to colonize with some kind of institutional framework and administrative structure and counterparts and elites. What you want is simply to wipe out the nation state altogether. You're not even going to have regime change anymore. Okay, we're not dealing with regime change. There is a regime there, and the United States now wants to get rid of this regime and replace it by three territories. And so it's not regime change. It's not regime rotation. It's the transformation of countries into territories, and it is implemented by supporting jihadist terrorist organizations, sending them in an environment where they can ultimately destabilize the prevailing government, and then eventually then the foreign investors will come in and pick up the pieces. And I should mention that is the scenario in Nigeria, where you have a country which also has sectarian divisions between Christians and Muslims, and where there's oil, you know, it's still the largest oil produced in Africa, a large population. What you do is that you have your intelligence apparatus which supports Boko Haram, which is an insurgency, a fundamentalist insurgency, kidnapping young girls, and you also support the government of that country. And then you intervene because you have to come in and intervene because the terrorists are there, and you have to deal with the terrorists, but the terrorists wouldn't be there if you hadn't financed them and supported them in the first place, okay? So there wouldn't be any Boko Haram in Nigeria if the CIA had not supported the formation of Boko Haram. That is the process in quite a number of countries. It's the case in Nigeria, it's the case in Somalia, in Yemen, it was certainly the case in Libya, where terrorist organizations are used as a mechanism of destabilization, but they're also used as a mechanism for intervention on a humanitarian, with a humanitarian mandate. In other words, coming in under counterterrorism, okay? And the irony is that these terrorist organizations are all created by U.S. intelligence, and then the United States comes in under the so-called war on terrorism with its counter-terrorist mandate to the rescue of the civilian population. What I'm saying is perhaps very, you know, schematic, but I can say that after more than 10 years of research, That is the conclusion to which I arrive, and it is so well documented that these terror organizations are instruments of U.S. intelligence that we have to ultimately acknowledge that. Now, the interesting thing is that the Western media, in their coverage of Iraq, they say very explicitly, and I quote, according to the Daily Express, British News, Daily News, quote, they're talking about ISIS. They had money and arms supplied by Qatar and Saudi Arabia. And then the Daily Telegraph says, it's a little bit more explicit. They said, through their allies, such as Saudi Arabia and Qatar, the West has supported militant rebel groups, which has since mutated into ISIS and other Al-Qaeda-connected militia. It's always a little bit convoluted, but at least they acknowledge the fact that these terrorist organizations are supported by Qatar and Saudi Arabia. But nobody seems to be bothered by that assertion, and nobody is actually investigating something which is well known, is that Qatar and Saudi Arabia, their respective intelligence agencies, work hand in glove with the CIA. We've known that. Now, if Qatar and Saudi Arabia were the sponsors of terrorism, and you were to apply U.S. foreign policy logic, what you should be doing is to invade Saudi Arabia and Qatar. That would be the way of resolving it, because all these organizations are funded by allies of the United States, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan's ISI, Inter-Services Intelligence. All of the United States' main allies are behind these terrorist organizations on behalf of Washington, but then that provides the opportunity to the United States to say, we are implementing a war on terrorism, and these organizations are independent of us. They may even acknowledge the fact that Saudi Arabia gives them support, but under no circumstances are they going to go and bomb Saudi Arabia for having created Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is a creature of U.S. intelligence, and it allows precisely the U.S. media to spin lies and lies and lies, because they say, well, no, the U.S. has nothing to do with these terrorist organizations. It's Saudi Arabia and Qatar who are supporting ISIS, but it fails to mention that both Doha and Riyadh are always acting on behalf and in close liaison with Washington.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, ISIS, an instrument of the Western Military Alliance. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, a few minutes ago, you brought up the water crisis and the fact that Turkey was shutting off the water of the Euphrates into Syria and then, of course, into Iraq. I had read about that, and I'm glad you brought that up because I'd forgotten about that. Now, you're talking about Qatar and Saudi Arabia being allies of the U.S. Turkey also is an ally of the U.S., correct? And also Turkey.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And Turkey has been involved all along in the upheaval in Syria, right?
Turkey has been providing a safe haven to the Al-Qaeda rebels in Turkey. They've also been involved in the training. They have a very close relationship with Israel. It's a military cooperation agreement. And so that if we're looking at the front runners of the, let's say, the war in Syria, who is behind it, it's certainly Saudi Arabia, Qatar, which are involved in training and recruiting the rebels. Turkey definitely as well. Jordan to a lesser extent. Israel out of the Golan Heights is supporting rebel formations, including al-Nusra. This is well known. So that now if we look at the issue of water, this is, in a sense, it's an absolutely devastating scenario, because the Turkish government cut off the flow to the Euphrates River. largely threatening Syria, but also Iraq with a major water crisis. And this potentially affects within Syria several million people. And now, bear in mind, is that the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria apparently were involved in blowing up one of the dams on the Euphrates. And this happened, I think, in late May. It was on the 30th of May, if I recall correctly. And so there we have a situation where the Al-Qaeda-linked ISIS, supported by the USA, is involved in acts of sabotage directed against the water supplies which are going towards Syria, so that we can see who is actually calling the shots in this regard.
And finally, on a global scale, we see Russia and China making long-term deals. We see the rise of the BRICS countries, all of these major actors on the global scene, of course, are now challenging U.S. hegemony. And, there, of course, there's a lot of talk about, you know, the fall of the West. How do you think this messing around by the United States continually in the Middle East is going to play out against larger events?
Well, I mean, this certainly we're in an era of confrontation between Russia and China on the one hand, and the Western military alliance on the other. On the one hand, the situation which is unfolding in Ukraine, the militarization of the whole of Eastern Europe and the Russian border, and then if we look at the Far East, Obama's pivot to Asia, and the threats directed against China's sovereignty, which includes not only NATO, it includes countries like Australia, South Korea, and the Philippines, which are now partners in this endeavor. So that we're at a very, very dangerous crossroads. We are dealing also with the potential dangers of nuclear war. And I should mention, and it's very important, this is not a new Cold War. If it were a new Cold War, we would have the safeguards of the Cold War era. We don't have those anymore. The Cold War era was an era of relative stability. Why? Because the competing superpowers understood that any kind of unilateral action on their part would lead to global destruction because of the fact that you could not... You cannot have a first strike. You did not envisage a first strike nuclear attack in the days of the Cold War. It was something which had been ruled out. It was called mutually assured destruction. But that doctrine, which ultimately is still relevant, has been scrapped. And it has been scrapped to the extent that nuclear weapons have been recategorized as safe for use in the conventional war theater, and they don't require presidential approval. They can be used by U.S. Central Command, and they have the so-called tactical nuclear weapons. So that nuclear war is certainly not something which can be ruled out. But, I mean, once a war starts, it escalates. And the situation in Ukraine is extremely dangerous because it's right at the Russian border, and it is supporting a government which is, for all sakes and purposes, is a neo-Nazi government, so that's another dimension. It's another historical dimension. And with regard to BRICS, I'm somewhat skeptical because, first of all, many of these countries are very much dependent on the United States, both for various reasons, but mainly in the spheres of economics. If you look at Brazil, now Brazil is an ally of the United States from a military standpoint. It's a dollarized economy. It is under IMF, World Bank auspices. Look at India. For the outgoing Prime Minister of India, Manmohan Singh, was a former World Bank official. They implemented neoliberal policies in starting in the early 90s. Look at China. China has applied the most vicious capitalist has the most vicious capitalist economy you can possibly imagine, with very, very low wages, with a migrant workforce of 250 million people, according to official figures. Okay, and these migrant workers are hired by factories, building sites, etc. It is not an alternative society as far as humanity is concerned. What we have is an opposition between, potentially between opposing blocs. But bear in mind that in many regards, China is the industrial colony of the United States, made in China. And they have trading relations, they have scientific relations, etc., etc., etc. And it is not China or even Russia which will uphold a progressive perspective on how you fight U.S. imperialism. And that's not what they're involved in. What they are concerned with is that they want to retain a certain element of sovereignty. And I say that we probably support that. Okay? We support China and Russia in their foreign policy, because we think that there's a certain element of balance in their positions. But we don't necessarily endorse the Chinese social structure, which is the most unjust social structure on planet Earth, with a small elite of extremely wealthy people and a process of impoverishment down to the factory and farm levels. So I'm not particularly... From that standpoint, I'm not particularly optimistic, and I don't think that the BRICS ultimately constitutes itself a countervailing force. It's a reunion of a number of countries, all of which have bilateral relations with the United States and the European Union, okay? And to say that this is the countervailing bloc, China and Russia as countries do constitute a countervailing bloc. And they also constitute a very large area extending it's the Eurasia corridor. But at the same time, you go to China and you realize that the Chinese banking system is integrated by Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan Chase, etc. They've opened up their banking system to Western financial interests. Then you go to the factories, and then you realize that the factories are all producing made in China for the U.S. market at $3 a day with very, very low wages. So the situation, these societies are tremendously divided. You may have an awareness in China that the country is being surrounded by U.S. military facilities. But if you raise this with the business community, they say, no, we're trading with them. If you go to the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, well, they have links with U.S. think tanks. If you go to the university, then you realize the School of Journalism at Tsinghua University is in partnership with Bloomberg, which is funding a graduate program there. And so that these countries are not necessarily sovereign in terms they may be sovereign in some regards, and they certainly do not constitute an alternative to global capitalism. And I think that's very important. The alternative to global capitalism has to come from the masses of people, both in different countries around the world. It's not Russia or China that are going to provide us with an alternative. But at the moment, I think it's very important to support some sanity in diplomacy and international relations. And I think it's fair to say that China and Russia foreign policy is somewhat of a different nature to that of the United States and its allies. Neither country has any hegemonic objective, at least in present history, and they don't constitute a threat to other countries. And but at the same time, they are very fragile because a good part of their economy is also dependent on the Western financial establishment, the hegemony of the dollar, and so on.
Michel Chosadovsky, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be on the program.
There's something happening here. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show has been ISIS, an instrument of the Western Military Alliance. Michel Chosadovsky is director of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. The Global Research website, globalresearch.ca, publishes news articles, commentary, background research, and analysis. Michel Chosadovsky is the author of The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, and America's War on Terrorism, as well as co-editor of the anthology, The Global Economic Crisis, The Great Depression of the 21st Century. All books are available at globalresearch.ca. That's globalresearch.ca. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner and Yaro Mako. To leave comments or order copies of shows, email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. That's Faulkner at gunsandbutter.org. Visit our website at gunsandbutter.org. It's the Secret Space Program and Breakaway Civilization 2014 Conference, Saturday and Sunday, June 28th and 29th, at the San Mateo Event Center, featuring speakers Joseph Farrell, Catherine Austin Fitz, Michael Schratt, Robert Morningstar, Richard Dolan, Carol Rosen, Mark McCandish, and John Rappaport. Is there a shadow and top secret space program? Visit the Secret Space Program and Breakaway Civilization 2014 conference website at www.secretspaceprogram.org for more information, ticket, and web stream sales. That's secretspaceprogram.org.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we live in, G. And our new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand. Divided we will fall, cause love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? This is a call to all you sleeping souls. Wake up and take control of your own cipher. And be on the lookout for the spirit sniper trying to steal your life. You know what I'm saying? Look what's inside yourself for peace. Give thanks, live life, and release. You dig me? You got me?
Bravo for Women in the Arts and Black Artists Contemporary Cultural Experience present the Bay Area premiere of Zakiya Alexander's Sweet Melody, running June 17th through August 3rd in a benefit for the Bravo Theater Center. Set during Reconstruction, Sweet Melodies follows the story of three recently emancipated sisters and their former mistress as they contemplate a future in a post-slavery America. Based on Jean Genet's The Maids, Sweet Melodies features the work of critically acclaimed actors Britt Frazier, Kehinde Koyejo, Stephanie Martin, and Lisa Ann Porter. Theater. Sweet Maladies runs June 17th through August 3rd at Brava Theater Center, 24th in York in San Francisco, and it is wheelchair accessible. Visit www.brava.org for tickets and information. That's the Bay Area premiere of Sweet Maladies, June 17th through August 3rd at Brava Theater Center in San Francisco.
And you're listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned for...